Franklin's theory had traction because it was built upon the prevalent English thinking of his time. He was less an innovator than he was an ingenious popularizer. His fame was such that his ideas about demographic expansion found fertile ground as the American Revolution arrived, when the iconic propagandist Thomas Paine presented a variation of Franklin's American breed to a receptive audience. Like Franklin, Paine imagined a people forged from unique conditions of its land and resources. The American breed was endowed with an instinctive, youthful, and forward-directed spirit. Paine's pamphlet, Common Sense, 1776, is heralded for having captured the spirit of the Revolution, replete with a potent language of natural rights and an economic justification for independence. For Paine, the unique character of America's empowered white inhabitants, supported by the unquestioned majesty of an extensive continent, was evidence of the irresistible sway of nature's law. He emphasized free trade and America's potential as a commercial empire. He celebrated the power of a burgeoning continent over the reach of distant kings, as he employed the rhetorical device of unnatural breeding to disavow monarchy. He forecast that independence would end the waste and idleness that prevailed under the colonial regime. Paine is actually an odd choice for modern Americans to celebrate as a revolutionary symbol. He was an Englishman born and bred. Better put, an Englishman in exile. When Common Sense was published in January 1776, he had been in Philadelphia for little more than a year. He had arrived with a letter of introduction from Franklin, which landed him a job editing the Pennsylvania Magazine, or American Monthly Museum, a venture committed to everything American, despite its unmistakable London design and English editor. Adding to the irony of the situation, he had been an excise man in England, and tax collectors did not fare well in the protests leading up to the Revolution. Though his pamphlet did not sell the 150,000 copies he claimed, it did win over George Washington, and it did reach audiences in New England, New York, Baltimore, and Charleston. Like his sponsor Franklin, Paine was fascinated by facts and figures, the stuff of political arithmetic and useful knowledge. Yet at the same time, he was not above quoting Aesop's fables. His pamphlet spoke a familiar language, a distinctly British language of commerce, employing a simple and direct style capable of reaching readers beyond the educated elite. Paine's writing is equally as revealing for what he does and doesn't say about class. He would not tackle the monopoly of land and wealth until 1797, after watching the French Revolution unfold, when he declared in Agrarian Justice that everyone had an equal and divine right to the ownership of the earth. In Common Sense, he pushed class, poverty, and other social divisions aside. Though he acknowledged the distinctions of rich, of poor, he directly dismissed the harsh, ill-sounding names that exacerbated class conflict. In two breezy paragraphs, he coupled the distinctions of class and sexual difference as phenomena beyond present political concern. They were differences derived from nature, effects that had come about by accident. They simply were. Class disparities did not rise to the level of justifying revolution. Paine's sleight of hand in concealing class reflected his preference for talking about breeds. His overarching argument was that European-descended Americans were a new race in the making, one specially bred for free trade instead of the state machinery of imperial conquest. His critique of the British political economy was centered on the enormous debts it incurred through expensive military adventures, which he blamed on the frivolous ambitions of English royalty. Over time, kings and queens had become wasteful heads of state, in and of themselves a social liability. He accused the monarchy of engrossing the commons, that is, destroying the representative nature of the House of Commons, the one branch that embodied the will of the rising merchant class in England. The American colonies, meanwhile, were being drained of their collective manpower and wealth merely to underwrite new overseas wars. Independence would allow America to begin the world over again, Paine declared dramatically. The new nation would signal a new world order. Unburdened by constant debt and a large military, it would be a vibrant continental power erected on the ideals of free trade and global commerce. As a promoter on the order of the Hakluyts, Paine conceived of America as an experimental society through which to adjust or recalibrate the very meaning of empire. Like past commentators, he extolled the natural resources of America, timber, tar, iron, and hemp. Corn and other agricultural goods would give America a leading role in feeding Europe. North America's major cash crop, tobacco, was starkly missing from his discussion. He used grain-producing Pennsylvania as his model, not Virginia. Most important, he insisted that independence would benefit both America and the British nation. Free trade, as he imagined it, did not discriminate. It knew no bounds. He even assured his American readers that English merchants would be on their side, wanting to protect and advance trade with America, rather than plunge the government of Great Britain into another costly war. He was right about some merchants, but dead wrong about the war. It was Paine's theory of human nature that led him to emphasize commercial alliances over class divisions. His mantra was, commerce was natural, monarchy was unnatural. In many of his writings, he argued that commerce emerged from mutual affections and shared survival impulses, while monarchy rested on plunder and overawing the vulgar masses. Ultimately, kings benefited no one but themselves. Your dependence upon the crown is no advantage, he told his readers in another essay, but rather an injury to the people of Britain, as it increases the power and influence of the king. They benefited only by trade, and this they have after you are independent of the crown. In this way, Paine saw commerce as the balm that smoothed over class differences and united the interests of British and American merchants alike. Paine knew that class tensions existed. He understood that revolutions stirred up resentments. In Common Sense, he adopted an ominous tone at a key point in his argument, warning readers that the time was ripe to declare independence and form a stable government. Or else. In the current state of things, the mind of the multitude is left at random, he wrote, and the property of no man is secure. Therefore, if the leadership class did not seize hold of the narrative, the broad appeal to political independence would be supplanted by an incendiary call for social leveling. Landless mobs were waiting in the wings if colonial leaders failed to act. For Paine, common sense meant preserving the basic structure of the class order and preventing the whole from descending into a mob mentality and eventual anarchy. An effective system of commerce needed a stable class system, but what it didn't need was dull-witted kings running the show. The practice of exalting one man so greatly above the rest was contrary to common sense and nature. Not only were the ignorant and unfit routinely elevated to kings, so were ennobled infants, as yet lacking reason. A king worn out by age and infirmity could not be legitimately removed from power. Here was nature out of control, deformed, perverted. Paine mocked the idea that English royalty were some new species, a race of men worthy of infallible stature. History did not justify any claim that the present race of kings had honorable, let alone divine, origins. William the Conqueror was a French bastard, an invader with his armed banditry, a usurper, a ruffian, Paine scoffed. In the course of desacralizing the British monarchy as an effete, if not defunct, breed, Paine repeated what other enlightened critics had already said. Recall that Paine had only been in America for 13 months in January 1776, when the first edition of Common Sense was published, and he had not yet traveled outside of Philadelphia. His knowledge of America was based mostly on newspapers and books, the squibs and scraps he collected from the storehouse of public knowledge in circulation in England and America. Paine asked Franklin, who was still in England as war approached, for a copy of Oliver Goldsmith's History of Earth and Animated Nature, 1774. Goldsmith, Franklin, and Paine all embraced the popular science of natural history, which divided the continents into distinct breeds or races of people. On this basis, Paine pursued two powerful arguments about breeding. One highlighted the notion that Britain's monarchy was rooted in antiquated thinking and political superstition. The other aimed to prove that Americans were a distinct people, a lineage based not on superstition, but on science. The widely regarded theories of Linnaeus, 1707 to 1778, and Georges-Louis Leclerc, Comte de Buffon, 1707 to 1788, which influenced Goldsmith's treatise, divided the world into varieties and races shaped by the environment unique to each major continent. The Swedish botanist Carl von Linné, better known to history as Linnaeus, organized all of plant and animal life and divided Homo sapiens, the word he coined for humans, into four varieties. The European type, he said, was sanguine, brawny, acute, and inventive. The American Indian he deemed choleric and obstinate, yet free. The Asian was melancholic and greedy, and the African was crafty, indolent, and negligent. This grand and ethnocentric taxonomy served Paine's purpose in justifying the American Revolution. To begin the world over again, Americans of English and European descent had to be a new race in the making, perhaps a better one, as they laid claim to North America. In Paine's simple formulation, breeding was either conditioned by nature or it was corrupted through superstition. The first possibility allowed a people's fullest potential to be unleashed, while the latter only reduced their ability to grow and improve themselves. Again, he was not alone in equating monarchy with bad breeding. Paine echoed another of Franklin's friends, the Unitarian cleric and scientist Joseph Priestley, who argued in 1774 that British subjects were comparable to the livestock on a farm, being passively transferred from one worn-out royal line to another. Even more telling, a newspaper article published in both London and Philadelphia in 1774 pointed out that the worship of kings was absurd and unnatural and defied common sense. This unnamed writer sarcastically contended that simpering lords in England would worship a goose if it had been endowed with all the royal trappings. The line that would have caught Paine's eye was this, that kings were made to propagate, to supply the state with an hereditary succession of the breed. But there was nothing sacred about a royal breed. Blind allegiance to what enlightened critics had reduced to a barnyard custom exposed how an intelligent, civilized people might lose their grip on reality. The natural order was greatly out of alignment. British kings were exalted above everyone else for no logical reason. Americans had a unique opportunity to break free from the relics of the past and to set a true course for a better future, one unburdened by the dead weight of kings and queens. It was this anti-authoritarian idea that made Paine's pamphlet most radical. If kings could be seen as ignorant and unfit, then why not royal governors, Quaker proprietors, or the better sort, riding in their carriages? If monarchy was not what it was supposed to represent, other customary forms of power could be questioned too. Class appearances might be similarly seen as mere smoke and mirrors. This is why Paine was careful to downplay the distinction between the rich and the poor. He wanted his American readers to focus on distant kings, not local grandees. He wanted them to break with the crown, not to disturb the class order. For like reasons, he turned a blind eye to slavery. Paine's America was, above all else, an asylum for future-directed Europeans. No one else need apply. He argued against the inherited notion that America was a dumping ground for lesser humans. It was only a sanctuary for able, hard-working men and women. This overly sanguine portrait cleaned up class and ignored what was unpleasant to look at. Indentured servitude and convict labor were still very much in evidence as the Revolution neared, and slavery was a fact of life. Philadelphia had a slave auction outside the London Coffee House at the center of town on Front and Market Streets, which was directly across from Paine's lodgings. In Common Sense, the propagandist mentioned Negroes and Indians solely to discredit them for being mindless pawns of the British when they were incited to harass and kill white Americans and to undermine the worthy cause of independence. The English military had stirred up Indians and Negroes to destroy us. Us against them. Civilized America was being pitted against the barbarous hordes set upon them by the hellish power of London. Paine's purpose was to remind his readers of America's greatness, drawing on the visual comparison of the continent in its size and separation from the tiny island that ruled it. In no instance hath nature made the satellite larger than its primary planet, he declared, magnifying Newtonian optics. The existing scheme did nothing but reverse the common order of nature. England belonged to Europe, he contended, and America belonged to none but herself. Canadians would demand their freedom, too, because according to Paine's taxonomic portrait, they were more American than English. They were as much the offspring of the North American continent as their forward-looking southern siblings, endowed with the same traits and ambitions. As he conjured an embryonic people, Paine gave consideration to one more element that impinges on our study of class. He was thoroughly convinced that independence would eliminate idleness. Like Franklin, he projected a new continental order in which poverty was diminished. Our present numbers are so happily proportioned to our wants, he wrote, that no man need be idle. There were enough men to raise an army and engage in trade, enough, in other words, for self-sufficiency. The land would only continue to be wasted if lavished by a king on his worthless dependents. Here Paine did take a swipe at the old Pennsylvania proprietors. With room to grow, the infant nation would reach new heights by displaying a manly, youthful spirit of commerce that Londoners once possessed but had since lost. The Revolution would end petty quarrels between colonies that had been nurtured in a culture of imperial dependence. Only through independence could America achieve its natural potential for commercial growth. For a long time, Great Britain engrossed us, Paine explained, proud to be part of his adopted home, his American asylum. The government in London and the crown were controlling land and resources of the North American continent for selfish purposes. But now the United Colonies were awake to a new reality. The British monopoly had run its course. Anything less than complete independence would be like wasting an estate on a suit at law to regulate the trespasses of a tenant whose lease is just expiring. Wasting an estate. Britain's lease was up. In advocating for an American breed bent on productivity and expansion, Paine's richly evocative language of waste, idleness, breeding, and engrossing of land fed excitable minds. Knowing his impressionable audience, he compared the coming revolution to Noah and the Great Flood. It would give birth to a race of men, perhaps as numerous as all Europe, their portion of freedom to be passed on to future generations. Population would grow and flourish as long as Americans filled the continent and harvested its resources for export. Paine's economic heroes were overseas merchants, commercial farmers, shipbuilders, inventors, and property-owning and property-protecting Americans, but decidedly not the landless poor. "Britain and America are now distinct empires," declared Paine in 1776. 6 years later, as the war was coming to an end, he would still be defending the distinct American breed. "We see with other eyes," he wrote, "we hear with other ears, and think with other thoughts than those formerly used." To his credit, Paine held nothing back in poking holes in the dogma of hereditary monarchy, but with his broad swipes at royalty, he obscured other forms of injustice. He too loosely clothed the language of class in the garb of continental races and commercial impulses. Indians and slaves are marginalized in his grand vision of a new world order. Neither did he allow the ignoble waste people to make any appearance in common sense. The vast numbers of convict laborers, servants, apprentices, working poor, and families living in miserable wilderness cabins are all absent from his prose. For Paine, the crucial issue for Americans in 1776 was not whether, but how soon a new and independent regime would advance toward its destiny as first among nations. He assumed that the mighty forces of commerce and continental expansion would eliminate idleness and correct imbalances. There was nothing wrong with cultivating Anglo-American commercial instincts and sustaining peaceful transnational trade alliances with Great Britain. But in other areas, Paine hoped that the British way of seeing and hearing would disappear from America. He presumed, incorrectly as it turns out, that class would take care of itself.